I'm going to let your listeners in on a really big secret. So the problems that I faced as a PE at Meta and the problems that I faced as an SRE manager and as an ops person at Acquia and even further back in my research computing days, a lot of the problems are the exact same problem, which is just the practice of operating a service. Regardless of size, teams, they need to learn about on-call. They need to learn about observability. They need to learn how to do releases, right? And they need to learn how to learn from failure. And that is a common problem across all companies. So I think it's important for your listeners to understand that we're all humans. And regardless if we're in a big company or a small company, some of the dysfunctions that happen on teams are going to be common to all of them.
Welcome to the All Things Ops podcast. On this show, we interview leaders in IT operations, DevOps, and AI ops about the ever-changing world of running an organization's technology. With our guests, we dive into things like, what does it mean to run large-scale IT infrastructures? How do you manage globally distributed operations? What are the complexities of hybrid IT? How can you best leverage automation? And last, but definitely not least, how do you keep an eye on things using monitoring and observability? This podcast is produced by Tribe29, the company behind CheckMK, the software of choice when it comes to monitoring hybrid IT infrastructures. I'm Elias Volker, and I will be your host today.
Welcome, everybody, back to the All Things Ops podcast. My guest for today's episode is Amin Astane. Amin is a site reliability engineering veteran. He's been doing this for more than 12 years, both as an SRE and then later an SRE manager at various companies. Most importantly, Acquia, mid-sized managed service provider, I believe, and then more importantly, Meta, also formerly known as Facebook. And he has recently started Certomodo, which is a consulting firm focused on helping companies mature their IT operations and up their SRE game, so to speak. And he'll tell us more about this. Amin, it's really great to have you on the All Things Ops podcast. Welcome.
Thank you, Elias. It's an absolute pleasure.
All right. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You have had quite a journey. You're a veteran of SRE, site reliability engineering. How did you get there and how did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, so we could talk a little bit briefly about, you know, where it got started. I got introduced to Linux when I was in high school, junior year, and I've been hooked. Like, I've really wanted to, you know, host and operate production services since then. You know, went to school for computer science, ran a supercomputer in my alma mater, and then joined Acquia. Went through that big 9-year story, grew as an engineer and as a leader there. And then, of course, did Meta for 3 years, where I was able to operate a larger scale service and see the differences and the similarities between large and small teams. But that's the executive summary.
All right. Well, we'll talk about scale in a minute. But before we get to that, now you've started your own business. You went out on your own, which is, I can tell you from experience, is quite exciting. I've done it for 6.5 years. So tell us what Certomodo does and what is your value proposition?
Absolutely. So Certomodo, it helps software engineering teams transform their operational posture using SRE and DevOps. In terms of what I do personally as a consultant, I'll wear whatever hat is necessary. I can be a fractional manager if you need it. I can be an individual contributor if you need it and write code and do infrastructure stuff. Whatever's needed to make that transformation possible. So here's the value prop. I help you reduce your operational cost of running production. We get your engineering team able to produce more features rather than handling all of that, you know, toil work, that non-value add work. And then create a better working environment by making on-call better and create a better experience for your customers. So it's win-win-win all around. That's
all right. All right. And we will talk about sort of the benefits of this kind of transformation also a little bit down the road. So if my math serves me right, you've been leading SRE teams for about 10 years now, give or take. Is the ideal SRE really 50% developer and 50% ops person, or is that sort of a myth created by that famous Google book?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I have a philosophy about this, and I want to preface it with that. I think that operations is part of the software engineering discipline. So if you're going to go and write code, you should understand how to run it and ideally be running it. But that said, when I think about SRE is, sure, you have an operational mindset, but you're tackling all of your problems using software engineering, using code. So again, like when we think about SRE is what happens when you ask a software engineer to design operations team. So I don't look at it as like a 50-50 split. I think that SRE is an integration of software engineering towards an operational goal.
Okay. Well, I would challenge what you just said about sort of you should know how to run it, because then you very quickly get into the it worked on my machine, and also sort of running it. And I mean, particularly if we talk about companies sort of like Meta and running it at scale is two very different things. And I guess you'll be hard pressed as a developer to test a thing that, you know, potentially hundreds of millions of users will be using at some point. So I guess there should be some dedicated operations experience in there somewhere as well, right?
I mean, certainly. I was on production engineering for 3 years. And the reason, at least for me and my interpretation of why I was there and why PE exists, is that, you know, we are introducing operational best practices to software engineering teams. And the reason why I find that to be very important is that in the least, we're building a culture of empathy where software engineers begin to understand how their code and how their changes to their code affects production. So even if you structure it so that way, engineering, all they really need to do is have some understanding of that connection and be on call every once in a while, I think you're making a huge improvement to the state of software engineering teams in general.
We've alluded to scale and, you know, scale things to production and whatnot a few times. Now, I think throughout your journey, you have seen sort of every scale there is. Acquia is about 1,000 people company, sort of mid-sized company. It's a tech-heavy company, but still sort of mid-sized. Sure. Meta is about as big as it gets. In terms of IT infrastructure. Now you're back to building your own company, so starting really small. And, you know, when you were in research computing, obviously HPC clusters are very powerful, but sort of, you know, it's relatively limited what you have in terms of infrastructure. And all of these sort of T-shirt sizes of infrastructure, you know, have some commonalities and different challenges. So what, besides sort of sheer size and number of systems, what are some of the commonalities and what are some key differences you would see if you reflect on your career?
Sure. I'm going to let your listeners in on a really big secret. So the problems that I faced as a PE at Meta and the problems that I faced as an SRE manager and as an ops person at Acquia and even further back in my research computing days, a lot of the problems are the exact same problem, which is just the practice of operating a service. Regardless of size, teams, they need to learn about on-call. They need to learn about observability. They need to learn how to do releases, right? And they need to learn how to learn from failure. And that is a common problem across all companies. So I think it's important for your listeners to understand that we're all humans. And regardless if we're in a big company or a small company, some of the dysfunctions that happen on teams are going to be common to all of them. So that's an interesting secret. Now let's talk about the differences. In large companies, like, you get a really cool advantage, which is a lot of the tooling, a lot of the services, a lot of the infrastructure, it's already built for you. So all you really need to do is learn and adopt what those tools are and maybe introduce them to your team. So that way you're able to, you know, start benefiting from the best practices that are already there. You know, of course,
on hopefully teams, they're best practices and not just practices.
Correct. That's right. And I mean, you know, there are certain companies and stories from my friends at larger companies where there are services that are like this, they provide the same purpose, but there's like three or four iterations of them, which is kind of hilarious. You know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. But yes, over time, larger companies are going to converge on a set of best practices, you know, use this tool for this thing, and then you're able to use all of them in conjunction to create a service that, you know, for the most part is running itself in the late game, right? Now, as for smaller companies, okay, you are now having to think about build versus buy and take on the cognitive, you know, load of learning all of these things. you know, when building infrastructure and operating it more maturely. But, you know, again, you also have the flexibility to choose the right tool for the job. You don't have this massive organizational momentum saying you have to use XYZ. Mm-hmm. Right. And then the final difference that I'll just mention briefly is that for larger companies, your scope as an engineer is going to be, you know, constrained. You're on a certain project, you're doing a certain thing. Whereas with smaller companies, you have a lot more freedom. You know, there's, you know, competencies that the business hasn't even thought of yet. And then you need to do it for, you know, compliance or risk management or whatever. And you get to jump in and do that stuff. So you become a jack of all trades. So mm-hmm. I think those are the differences in dynamic between large and small companies.
Okay. Would you say that there are certain things that a large company can do that, you know, smaller companies simply can't afford, or has the advent of sort of public cloud services and making everything available in sort of bite-sized increments from AWS or Google or Azure leveled that playing field largely?
Sure. I suppose the playing field has been leveled to a point. So when I was at Meta, you know, they have knowledge of all of the systems that they are running, and each system has its own team. Each team is on call. Each team has its own support structure and a way to reach out to them. So you're in the situation where, oh, I need to learn how to use this tool, or, oh, this tool isn't working. Let me go ask for help. And you end up with, you know, like a day or less response with a human being, and you're able to work together and you know, solve issues. Now, if you are a smaller company and you're using cloud, sure, you can get that too, but you're going to be paying a lot of money for the support contract to make that possible, right? So I think that those are the major differences. Like, yes, you can do it as a smaller org, but you're going to be paying out the nose to get that level of high touch.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Yeah, makes sense. Now, if we go back further in time at Acquia, you were actually the one, if I understand this correctly from our previous conversation, who led the DevOps transformation and really built up the SRE practice from scratch.
That's correct.
What triggered this? What were the motivations to go down that route? I guess to some extent because it's fashionable, maybe something else as well. And what were some of the things that you learned along the way?
Yeah, what an amazing question. So in the beginning, I was a manager in a cloud operations team at Acquia. So what did that team do? We were responsible for provisioning infrastructure, monitoring it, doing releases, and doing incident response for the flagship product that was bringing in the majority of the revenue at the time. Mm-hmm. So Acquia was very successful. They got a lot of customers in a very short period of time. So all of those little tasks that we were doing that were manual, they magnified in size. And that created a lot of toil for us and a lot of just operational pain. So small amount of customers, small amount of alerts, large amount of customers, large amount of alerts.
So this is when ex-consultants like me just say, this just doesn't scale.
Sure. I guess that would be true. But, you know, me being a full-time employee and a manager, I had a responsibility, not just, you know, to the business function that I was responsible for, but also to my team. They were on call. They were dealing with the pain. They were dealing with the stress, and I wanted them to have relief. So there was a personal reason as to what motivated me to get into the industry. And I feel the same way today. I don't want engineers to have a bad experience running software. So I started to ask if there was a better way. And I ended up going to DevOps Days in 2015 in Boston. And while there, I was starting to ask questions, and someone was like, oh, go read The Phoenix Project, which is like the seminal book about DevOps. Like, everyone starts there. Mm-hmm. So I read that book and I got turned on. And then I started reading even more books because there's a ton of books. The book, The Phoenix Project, is really the start. There are so many other roads you can go on. So I was just reading like a big stack of books. I must have spent like $500 over the past decade, you know, just like reading and reading and reading. And I started to gather metrics on my team's performance, and that led to, you know, the cultural change, like the beginning. So over time, one of the biggest things I learned on this journey is that DevOps and SRE are social exercises. Mm-hmm. They're things that you do with other people. It isn't something that you create a team, put them in the corner, and then have them go do. It has to happen with collaboration with other teams. And that's because to do it well, you're introducing new ideas to the company and you're changing their culture. Mm-hmm. And that is inherently cross-functional. And you have to start thinking about like social skills, like emotional intelligence and using your perception just as much as, you know, learning about software development or specific tools to solve problems. Mm-hmm. And then another thing that I think is really important that I want people to take away if they're leading a DevOps transformation or thinking about doing one or doing SRE, you need support from the C-level to do this in the long term and to be successful at it. So you can do grassroots in the beginning and work with, you know, people on your team and work with other teams and improve things locally there. Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to discourage people from doing that, but there will be a point where C-level people with the purse strings and people with responsibility over policy, they need to start making decisions. And without their support, you're not going to be able to change the culture of the company in the long term.
That's very interesting. And I want to dive deeper on this, but one thing that you just said resonated with me, what you said about sort of work-life balance and sort of these on-call. I actually, this morning, read the 2023 IT operations survey that is published by Kaseya. And there was a chapter on work-life balance for IT operations and DevOps teams. And like I don't have the exact figures in mind, but it was like, you know, 60 something percent have had to work on holidays or on the weekend. You know, I don't know, 30 something percent missed an important family event due to, you know, whatever on-call incidents, whatever. So, that's very sort of unpleasant. And you could say, hey, it's part of the job and you chose that job. But on the other hand, if you can minimize this, and that's also why there's people leave that part, and where there's a shortage of people because of exactly these conditions. And the worse this is managed and the worse the situation is, and the more you have these all-nighters and these kind of things. So yeah, I that resonates very much with me, what you said about sort of the personal motivation for you and your team to just basically improve the conditions under which you operate. So totally get that.
Yeah, thank you. That's right. I mean, that is why I'm in this industry, is to try to solve that problem one company, one team at a time.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great motivation. Now you went through this process, and you were with Acquia for about a decade almost. So you saw this project through, so to speak. What were some of the positive results that you saw, and what was really what created buy-in from the organization in along this transformation?
Yeah, sure. Good question. So let's talk about the buy-in first. I think the buy-in was first gathering metrics about the current state of the system. So we were able to quantify, you know, the amount of alerts that the operations team was generating and the types of alerts we were getting and being able to do Pareto, you know, like 80-20 rule and figuring out what the big sources of pain were. And, you know, being able to express these metrics in time and money really made it easy for the C-level to reason about like, okay, we're spending this much money on this. This isn't really helping our bottom line. So we need to do something about it. Right. So that was like the first step. Mm-hmm. We had an awareness now of the state of the team and made it visible. And the reason why I focused on operations so much is because they were the central nexus of a bunch of teams' requests. Like a bunch of work was being done. Like many value streams were being enabled by operations. Mm-hmm. So gathering metrics on it was, you know, job one. But in terms of like what things we produced over this journey, there are quite a bit. So for the operations team in particular, we reduced lead time, you know, from the moment of submission to the moment of completion. We reduced it by 50%, you know, through process improvement, through some automation and through some, you know, tooling in the right places. So we were able to increase throughput and you know, build a sense of credibility with the rest of the organization. And then on the engineering side, for the flagship product, there was a period of time where code releases were very slow and very painful. And we had an engagement, an SRE engagement that reduced, you know, time for changes from 80 days to like 2 weeks by making an architectural change and getting SRE involved to carry out that shift. So that was a huge win. And then there were a few, there was a bunch of other like fringe benefits that I could talk about briefly. Engineering gained a sense of urgent, like a sense of agency. They felt like they can start changing things because I was starting to show them that, yeah, we can try this. And we got goodwill from, you know, all the various teams and C-level everything. So there was a moment where the engineering organization facilitated and planned and executed on their own reorg. Mm-hmm. Where they had an understanding of what they needed to do in order to organize themselves and their work for it to go better. Mm-hmm. And they felt free and free and open and confident enough to have that discussion and execute on it, which was really cool to see. Mm-hmm. They started to be on call. There was a period of time where engineers were not on call. It was just ops for the flagship product. And we you know, introduced on call to them and shared that responsibility.
Sort of as a third level or how was yes. that sort of, okay.
Yes. For the other services and products, like engineering owned the service top to bottom, operations existed for the flagship product. Don't really.
Gotcha.
But yeah, like we created that culture shift of service ownership. Like if you build it, you own it. That permeated the entire engineering organization. We started doing blameless postmortems and introduced that across the organization, and people were documenting them and tracking improvements. We started doing launch readiness activities. We created like a criteria of like, okay, what do we need to do before we launch? So that way we do so successfully and we get customers confidence from day one, rather than the classic, you know, issue where you launch something and it breaks and then customers are a little, you know, not super confident whether or not they should go all in on the product. And then the final thing I want to mention is that, like, you know, we created a culture of empathy between teams. We became more cross-functional. We were able to work together and look at a similar vision and strategy. And I mean the result, like a monetary result, like let's put a bow on this. Acquia got acquired by Vista Equity Partners in 2019 by the time I left. You know, so and that was a successful exit for me, and that was a successful exit for a lot of people. So I think there was a financial and monetary, you know, benefit to it as well. Of course, I'm not going to claim that my efforts did all of that, but I think I was a contributor to that result.
Yeah, it's one piece of the puzzle, and definitely something sort of when I think back to sort of my consulting days when we would, you know, support in due diligences and these kind of things. It's definitely something you look at, sort of the maturity and resilience of operations, IT operations specifically. You know, is this all sort of held together with a little bit of duct tape and string, or is there actually, you know, solid processes, and can it sustain if, you know, a few key people leave, or will everything fall apart? So yeah, there's definitely a contribution there. Now today you switch sides. You're not sort of on the operator anymore, but you sort of help companies build their operations. And I assume that many times you work with companies that might not be as far along in their journey as Meta or as Acquia was when you left. Sure. What are some of the things that you look for when you start working with a customer? Maybe some quick wins that you find quite often.
Sure. So when I start working with a company, I look at something called reliability fundamentals. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by reliability fundamentals is, let's start with observability. You know, do they understand the state of production? Is there a dashboard I can look at with the key operational metrics? Do they have SLOs? You know, it'd be good if they had SLOs. Most teams don't, but it's good to see if they have them. And then, okay, beyond observability, what's their incident response process look like? You know, how is on call? Are teams overburdened with alerts? Are they actionable? Are customers the monitoring system? I've seen that too, where customers are filing complaints and then, you know, the engineering
something must be wrong. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's not a good thing either. So how is the incident management process done? Do they do postmortems? Or is there something that's showing them how to learn from failure so they can incorporate that back into the product and their processes? Are engineers on call equitably? Like I was mentioning in Acquia, like we had to introduce the idea of on call to engineering teams. You know, what is the responsibility you know, shifted to in service ownership? Is it shared evenly or is there a team doing it? Like, that's an important thing to know. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I look at change management. How do you implement changes on the system? How does code release work? If something goes wrong, can you roll back quickly or do you have to fail forward? Are you using CI or CD tools? What types of tests are you using? How often are you pushing to prod? So all of those aspects are really important to look at first. And, you know, in terms of like getting those quick wins, I start helping teams get those processes in place. You know, like, let's get some operational metrics on a dashboard so we can see the state of prod, get some run books written. So that way, if something breaks, we know how to fix it and we don't have to rely mm-hmm. on one person with the tribal knowledge. Document how code release is done so it's done consistently. Teach teams how to do postmortems, so that way they can do so in a blameless manner, learn from failure, track, you know, improvements in their issue queue. And really the goal here is I'm trying to create a positive feedback loop in place where, oh, we had an incident, we've learned from it, we're tracking the improvement, we do the improvement, things get better. And that builds mm-hmm. confidence and we keep doing it until the team is more mature, customers are more happy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Now, if you have to choose one, what to tackle first, is it sort of creating transparency and sort of the key metrics, the key, the dashboard, the overview?
That's a really good question. So I would say yes. And if you ever read the Google book, there's something called the reliability pyramid, mm-hmm. Right? By a former Google SRE who used to work for the US Digital Service. Mikey Dickerson, he created something called the reliability pyramid, which is like the Maslow's hierarchy. It needs the bottom is monitoring and metrics.
Yeah.
So you have to do that first. And because mm-hmm. without that, you're flying blind. You do not know the state of production.
Well, you don't know the state and you also don't know whether what you're doing is working. Because
100%.
If you don't have a baseline that you say, okay, you know, whatever you're tracking, if you don't have a baseline, then you don't know if what you just did actually worked, whether it improved right. against that baseline. So, but now that we're on the topic of monitoring and tools in general, observability, let's talk about that a little bit. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if there's not enough money in the world to buy all tools that, you know, monitoring, observability, CI, CD, you could probably spend an entire Fortune 50 company's IT budget and then some on these, and you still wouldn't have bought everything. So what would you consider sort of the absolute essentials for a modern SRE, and what are more sort of nice to haves? Where and maybe as a follow-up to this, what is an area where companies in your experience typically underinvest, and where do they just sort of actually, yeah, it's nice, but it doesn't move the needle all that much and they overinvest maybe?
Yeah, sure. Now that's a really good question. So let's break it down. Essential tools for site reliability engineers. So yes, we were just mentioning, you know, good observability and alerting. Now, you can be very choosy about the tools you use in the beginning to constrain your costs, right? So when we're talking about observability, when you're getting started, we're talking about logging. And you can be very, you know, judicious about what you log and how long you store it in order to keep the cost down. And logs are really useful to, you know, track errors, request rates, that sort of thing, and be able to create aggregations or new metrics off of that. But you also want a good, you know, alerting system, being able to use those metrics from logging and be able to detect when there are failures and respond to them quickly. I would be remiss if I didn't mention some kind of time series system. Mm-hmm. And again, it can be a very, you know, modest budget, and you could be very choosy about the metrics you emit in store. But it's good to have a time series system where you're able to track things like latency and error rate and, you know, the raw operational metrics that really, really matter to you, particularly mm-hmm. around service level objectives. Right? Mm-hmm. So an SRE is going to tend to focus like, okay, let's get SLOs on the board. And, you know, if you just implemented SLOs and you use those tools, you're going to be better off than where you started. Right. So we talked about that. You need a configuration management system of some kind. Especially mm-hmm. when you're dealing with growing scale in the number of services or instances of your app or, you know, VMs or whatever, you need to be able to apply changes to that infrastructure consistently. I know in the old days, you know, we built, you know, servers by hand. And I think there's a risk of that kind of coming back when it comes to what I would call click ops, which is you go into the AWS, you know, console and you're making your edits in there. I mean, it's the same model. So it's really good to have configuration management. So that way you're making your infrastructure consistently operated.
Mm-hmm.
Next, I know you're saying tools, but I think this is a tool and I would be remiss if I didn't say this. It's good to know, you know, one or two scripting languages as an SRE. And the reason why is that you're going to encounter manual tasks that are happening all the time. And in order for your team to scale, in order for a product to scale, you need to aggressively automate those tasks away.
I thought ChatGPT can do that now.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Yeah. I mean, can it? I mean, sure. You can ask it, hey, write, you know, this piece of code to do this task, but I certainly hope that you are reviewing that code, that you understand the code that was generated and that it's commented and that, yeah, you're not just like, yeah, write me a script and then run it in production. That is very risky. I would not be doing that.
Yeah.
So
I agree.
Yeah. Right on. Now let's talk about underinvestments. So I'm going to have a hot take. This is probably going to be the moment where I have a hot take in this podcast episode. I think we underinvest in like low level operating systems knowledge and low level CLI tools. And the great thing is you don't have to invest any money in getting these. It's just the time to learn them. So what I mean by this is that engineers, especially these days, they tend to use like web UIs. They tend to use, you know, higher order tools, which are very useful because you can aggregate a lot of data. But when there is that problem that monitoring system or that tool doesn't automatically expose and you have to go deep to go find the problem, that's when a lot of teams fall short. So I think it's really important that teams spend some time going back to the basics. Mm-hmm. Can you interpret the output of tools like VMstat and Top and Free and read logs and understand what is happening under the hood? Because there will be moments in your career where that is necessary, because the higher level tools aren't measuring the things that you need. Things that you can overinvest in, but you don't really necessarily need. Another hot take, probably distributed tracing. Unless you have a full blown, you know, distributed system and a bunch of microservices, and you're trying to track, you know, the latency of a request between system and system, I don't think that's something you want to necessarily invest in immediately unless you're already going, you know, 100% all in to, you know, microservices or distributed. I think it's totally fine to start with, you know, end-to-end latency of your requests. So I think there are some investments in observability that if you make them too early, you're just wasting money. Like there are moments in the early game where Yagni applies. You ain't gonna need it. And I think that's one of those examples.
All right. Yeah, that's two hot takes.
Thank you.
You spoke about moments in your career where you will need it, which brings us maybe to some of the favorite moments in your career and sort of maybe a war story or two from the trenches. What was one of those moments when you really needed that CLI knowledge to find the non-obvious problem?
Oh yeah, this is a fun one. I have a couple of stories, but let's talk about this one because I think it's interesting and relevant to this podcast. So again, I was a manager of an ops team back in Acquia back in the day, and we had a bunch of EC2 instances, you know, order of the thousands. We were using Puppet to admin. Mm-hmm. That was our CM system. And the thing about Puppet is that you're using a centralized Puppet server. All the manifests are stored on it. Every host has to authenticate into it to get its manifest and apply it. And so our flagship product had multiple, you know, environments, and the biggest ones, Puppet server, went down.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, in the thinking about it, it's not really a big deal. It just means that host can't apply state. But the thing is, we were monitoring using Nagios and an early version of CheckMK, You know, this, yeah, believe it. I mean, CheckMK, and when I was using it at that time, was amazing. Cause like the centralized metrics and the visibility to the state of the system was superior to what Nagios could do at the time. And that mm-hmm. was why we were using it. But anyway, so we had all of the hosts getting monitored as to whether or not they could do a Puppet run. And of mm-hmm. course, none of them could. So mm-hmm. we had this massive amount of alerts that got routed to the on-calls mailbox. Now, at the time, we weren't using systems like PagerDuty that would go and, you know, absorb all of the alert traffic and then dispatch it to the right person. We were just doing plain email because at the time PagerDuty was very new or didn't even exist yet. Mm-hmm. So what ended up happening was that silently behind the scenes, the recipient of the alerts was going to a Google mailbox for the on-call, and Google said, no more. Too many emails. I'm not accepting any more emails. So the on-call engineer stopped getting paged.
Okay.
Right. So they no longer.
So you're flying blind.
You're flying blind. And the on-call was dealing with this for several hours. And then they call me up and say, Amin, I have been staring at, you know, the dashboard for hours. I don't know what to do. And this is after the Puppet server got recovered, by the way. Like, this is still a problem. So I had to go and rage code up a solution, which was, okay, I'm going to create a mail server in Amazon running proc mail that would take in all of this alerts email and be able to route it to the correct place. And the problem that solved is that we were taking in all of the email rather than Google directly taking in all the email. So we didn't have to deal with like reputation issues. We were able to establish filters on that mail, which is what I was doing, and only sending the critical messages mm-hmm. to the recipients. Mm-hmm. And you know, after that, we were able to get, you know, mail delivery on the alerts backup in the short term. And believe it or not, that alerts host remained in production for many years and did so after I left. That was our mm-hmm. way to be able to control the flow of alerts rather than just sending all of them full bore into a mailbox. So mm-hmm. that was how we were flying blind and, you know, were able to stop that situation. Proc mail. Knowledge okay. of mail servers and proc mail saved the day on that one, you know?
All right. Now, I imagine from what you're saying, you said it was your flagship product. You said it was sort of the big, this didn't go entirely unnoticed from your customers, right? Or was that something that happened in the background and everybody in the front was waving and smiling?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that I don't remember if there are any customer outages during that period, but let's assume that they were. The impact would be that they would go and notify support. Support would end up, you know, sending an email, and then, oh, the email isn't working because it's using the same mailbox as it. Yeah. So that would have been the impact if there was a customer outage during that time that required immediate mm-hmm. response. Mm-hmm. So there would have been potentially a increase in time to remediate, right?
Okay. But it's not something that immediately affected the actual production system that your customers were using. Okay.
No, it wasn't that sort of thing. It was just very scary.
Dodged a bullet there. Yeah, yes. Of course, if you're flying blind. And I mean, we have this discussion with our customers sometimes about sort of, you know, in a sense, we do monitoring. If your monitoring system goes down, in the first instance, nothing happens. It's just your monitoring system. Obviously, you're flying blind, which is a very uncomfortable state to be in, but sort of nothing happened yet. Obviously, if something happens now, sort of in the logical second after your monitoring system went down, you won't know about it, and then that creates all kinds of different problems. So sure. Sometimes it's you know, you have these crazy requirements for a system that you run yourself and you can sort of backup restore within, you know, whatever, 3 minutes or so. Do we need like, you know, geo-redundant high availability to monitor our 17 servers? Like, maybe not.
No.
But so, yeah, that's a very interesting. I mean, obviously, alerting is sort of one step further down the incident management workflow, but it's a bit of the same thing. If your alerts don't work, for a while, you will be okay. It's just very uncomfortable because the absence of a message doesn't necessarily mean the absence of a problem.
Correct.
So that's right. Yeah, very, very interesting. Now we are sort of coming towards the end of this interview. And at the end, I always like to ask my guests a few questions, some a little bit more tongue in cheek than others. Now, how old were you when you first, I mean, you said you discovered Linux in junior high or as a junior in high school, you said, but have you been working with computers before that? When were you first exposed really to, you know, dabbling with computers?
Yeah. That's right. Just to clarify, I was exposed to Linux in 11th grade, but mm-hmm. I was originally exposed to computers in general when I was five.
Oh, wow.
So my grandfather, he lived with me for a period of time. And during that time he had an IBM PC with DOS on it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had some like tutorial program that I was able to run, and it taught you how to type. And then it also taught you how to mouse, like mm-hmm. the mouse driver worked on this machine, and mm-hmm. I was able to learn, you know, the basics of interacting with a computer. But also in kindergarten, at my school, they started putting Apple IIe machines.
Okay.
And the teacher was asking me, of all people, hey, do you want to like learn how to type your story on an Apple IIe? And I'm like, sure, heck yeah, let's go. And I started to learn, you know, real basic word processing on an Apple IIe when I was five. And that took off. I mean,
I couldn't even write when I was five, much less type.
My handwriting has remained garbage throughout the years because I've spent more time typing than I did writing. Like cursive, mm-hmm. I just couldn't pick it up. I refused to because I'm like, you can type on this keyboard. Why do I need to learn this antiquated thing? Mm-hmm. But yeah, 5 years old.
Okay. And how long did it take to break your first computer?
Yeah, this is a good one. I was 13, I think. So my parents got me an old school like Windows 3.1 system, and it had mm-hmm. DOS on it. And I remember like it was a used computer. So the registry, like when you look up, who owns the computer, it had someone else's name on it. And I'm like, nah, I want Amin Astani as the owner of this machine. Mm-hmm. So I was going around through the machine and found like the registry file, which I had no idea what that was. And I simply went into the text file and removed the text for the name of the former owner and put my name in it, and then rebooted the machine. And surprisingly enough to me at that time, the machine would not boot up, as in Windows 3.1 would no longer start because I corrupted mm-hmm. the registry because it's a binary file and I was trying to treat it like it was ASCII. So I was in DOS all summer long, until a friend who had a copy of a Windows 3.1 on floppies, and I was able to get my ancient Windows machine back up.
But yeah, okay.
That's a fun time.
Okay. Yeah. Now you've already alluded to the next question because you've mentioned Linux and how fond you are of Linux and how hooked you are on it. Sort of. So I assume your favorite operating system is still Linux. And you're very much an open source person. I saw actually, I think you posted something on open source software just very recently on LinkedIn, if I remember this correctly. So you're an open source guy, right?
Yes. I remember reading How to Be a Hacker by Eric S. Raymond when I was in 11th grade and being like, oh, this is really interesting, and reading all the stuff in the GNU project. I got really turned on to it because of the human ethos around it. The idea uh-huh. that, you know, we are creating freedom for other human beings by giving them control over the machines that they are running, which uh-huh. of course, prior to the advent of open source and free software and Linux, we didn't have that. Like we had what we were given and we didn't have control over it. So yeah, I've been a Linux user since 2002. I'm, you know, doing this call using Ubuntu LTS. I have an i3 window manager. That's how I've been rolling for many years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Now, You started in cloud operations. But I know that for example, Meta is using ginormous on-prem. They have their own cloud essentially because their scale is so large. Where do you fall on the spectrum of sort of run everything in the cloud, or maybe it's a good idea to run this sort of on our premises?
Sure. It all depends. It depends on your scale and where you are in the story of your business. If you're a startup, you don't want to have to deal with getting on-prem and waiting to get, you know, your infrastructure provisioned and deal with all of the operational responsibilities around power and around HVAC and all of that. So early game, cloud makes a lot of sense. You're able to get compute very quickly. You have a lot of options. You know, you're able to get started with a modest level of capital upfront. However, there is going to be a point where your scale is so large that the cost of that convenience is actually pretty enormous. Mm-hmm. So there is a point, like, of course, with Google scale and Meta scale, where they decided to run their own data centers because it actually cost them less money to do so. So, you know, I think that the answer is either or. It just depends on where you are and what your use case is and how early in the game you are in terms of building and launching a business.
I'd agree. I think obviously, you know, you always, in any aspect of life, and this is not limited to technology, you pay for convenience, you pay for flexibility. As with anything, you know, if you have a rental car, this, you know, if you add it up over the entire lifetime of the car, this will be much more expensive than just buying a car outright. But if you only need a car for a week, it looks much different. So, to wrap up, where can people get in touch with you? What's the best place to find you? Are you on Twitter? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Threads? I have to ask now. What's the best place to find you?
Yeah, absolutely. So the best place to find me, especially if you're interested in procuring my consulting services, is at certomodo.io, which is spelled certomodo.io. I'm also Amin Astani on LinkedIn. I am A. Astani on Twitter. And I am Amin.Astani on Threads. Yes, I created an account a couple of days ago. I said, and have done nothing since.
Okay. So I was about to ask, because I mean, this was like, you know, obviously, I feel like a week ago, this was the Twitter killer. And then now a week later, everybody's, you know, we're doing like the Gartner hype cycle, but in 2 weeks. So, you know, this is the next thing since, in Germany, you would say it's since sliced bread. And then now it's like, oh, usage is way down and whatever. So you seem to confirm that pattern. You signed up, you said hi there, and then sort of crickets, or is it somewhere in between?
I think it's somewhere in between. I mean, I personally have an incentive to use these services for marketing. Like I try to post on LinkedIn and Twitter, you know, every business day just to share my knowledge of the space and get people interested in what I'm doing. But for my personal life, I don't think I've quite gotten into the place where I am, you know, broadcasting my innermost thoughts in 256 character chunks on the internet just yet.
Probably a good idea. I'm off, and so with the exception of LinkedIn, which I use obviously for professional reasons, same. I'm completely off social media of any kind. And to be honest, I don't miss it. But we're getting sidetracked. Is there anything that our audience can help you with? Obviously, you know, you're always on the lookout for additional clients. That's obvious. But is there anything else that you're very interested in, or that you want to, you know, point people to, an interesting open source project or something like that?
Yeah, what a really good question. So there's something really interesting that's been going on in the open source world for the past few weeks. I know we alluded to it. Check out Jeff Geerling. He is a YouTuber that is very interesting. He spent a lot of time, you know, showing people what Raspberry Pis can do, but lately he's been saying a lot about open source and the recent, you know, news around Red Hat and the way that they are distributing source packages for their RHEL operating system. If you're not aware of that, I think it would be good just to check out and also to take some time looking back at open source history, you know, the old players, and understand why open source and free software exists and how it benefits humanity, not just companies. Mm-hmm. But I think that's my answer.
All right. Yeah, speaking of the history of open source, if you haven't read it, I can highly recommend the book, The Innovators, which is sort of the history of computer science, which obviously is also, you know, a large chunk of that is the history of open source. So that's a very, very good read, sort of on the beach during on the holidays or something like that. I don't know if you've read it. This brings us to the end. Amin, this was fun. Thank you so much. Thanks for sharing your knowledge and your experience and your story from the trenches. Best of luck with, you know, continuing to grow your business. And yeah, I look forward to connecting at some other point, conference or whatnot, or when you ever, if you ever want to check out the Atlanta tech scene, you're highly welcome, of course.
Thank you, Elias. It's been a pleasure.
Great.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the All Things Ops podcast. If you liked this episode, leave us a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast player. This podcast has been brought to you by Tribe 29, the CheckMK company. For more resources, head over to checkmk.com/podcast. If you want to send us feedback or suggest a guest, please drop us an email at podcast@checkmk.com. Until next time, happy monitoring.